kitchen, the laundry. And that's about it.
My name is Niels, I come from Germany and I'm a pilgrim.
What's your last phrase?
We didn't hear you.
I'm a pilgrim.
Pilgrim.
My name is Mike Eisensee, and this last year I worked in the Lutheran Volunteer Corps in Washington, D.C. at the Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs, which is the federal public policy office of the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.
My name is Jim Oinas, and I'm the pastor here at Holden Village now. For about a month, I've been the pastor here. And before that, I was pastor for 14 years at Alzona Lutheran Church in Phoenix, Arizona.
We'll ask each of them to have 5 minutes to address us, and then we'll give them a chance to respond to each other if they want to say anything to each other, and then we'll expect to hear from you. We'll limit your time, too. But you can respond any way you would like to after these folks have spoken. So we'll go to you, Agnes.
Well, I worked with the Lutheran Volunteer Corps for a year in Baltimore. And the Lutheran Volunteer Corps worked for justice. And my job that year was working in a soup kitchen, feeding the homeless and the hungry. And the way that we found out that justice can be done through solidarity, through sustainability, through sufficiency, and through participation, and definitely through participation. And it was not easy to leave home in Washington here and go cross country to Washington, D.C. I think my friends all thought I was to Baltimore. I think my friends all thought that I had lost my marbles or something leaving home and going. But my husband had passed away, and I had time now to go out and do things. This was certainly an experience that I would recommend anybody to go to, if they're willing to give up a year of their time. It's a year commitment, but working with the homeless and the hungry. The first day I was there, needless to say, I was probably scared to death to meet these people. Thought, what am I doing here working with these people? It wasn't long before the people that came in that were homeless and hungry were my friends, the same as I have made friends here at Holden Village. I could hug them, I could talk to them. It was just, they were the same as you and I are, only I had a job working there. It was volunteer work, but they were hungry. We treated these people in a very nice way. We thought most places where people are hungry and homeless, they stand in line waiting to get this, waiting to get that, waiting to get food stamps or whatever. They did have to wait in line to come in and sit down. But once they came in, they were seated at a table. They were served by the volunteers. They were asked if they wanted a regular meal or they were vegetarian, they were given a vegetarian meal. And many, many of the homeless people, as they walked out, took time out to thank us, and they really felt that someone cared about them. It was the one place where they were treated like a guest. They were not just standing in line waiting to have something put on their plate. And I think it gave me a feeling of, well, it's hard to describe the feeling that you get. You get so much more of what you give than what you are giving. The people give back a lot to you. Families would come in with little children, and it's really hard to see anybody, but with small families coming in with small children, it's really sad. And a lot of these children were not in school because they had no roots. There was no place for them to settle down. And it's very, very difficult. But through people working together, through the churches in Baltimore, they had, I don't know how many churches were connected with it, but we had 3,000 volunteers on the list of people that would come in and work. We had many businessmen that weren't afraid to come in, take off their suit coat, loosen their tie, roll up their shirt sleeves, wash dishes for an hour, stood there talking to the homeless people like I'm sitting here talking to you. And it was just such a wonderful feeling to know that all of us could work together. Black people, white people, other color races. There was no distinction. Everybody just worked together. And I think it's things like this. When you get out from a different area than where you live, we know we have homelessness in Seattle because I worked down at the Compass Center, but it's a little different when you're out there working with the people every day. When I was there, the average we were feeding was 450. And I was back in Baltimore last spring. It now is up to about 750 average. And they have fed as high as 1,200 people in one day. Now this is just one place. There are many, many places in Baltimore plus all the other places in the country. We don't stop to think of how many homeless and hungry are out there every day. And it doesn't solve the problem. It's only a stopgap, being able to feed these people. But maybe if we all pull together and we all think a little more about that person out there as homeless, maybe we can get justice for these people and get a home for them, find a place for them to live. And this is what the majority of them want. There's always going to be some people that definitely are homeless and don't want anything different. But the majority of them would like a home the same as you have or I have, and really would like to have a job and work. Because when they can take time out to come and thank you, and when you have people that say it was the biggest step in their life was when they had to come in that first time because they had lost their job. And there was many people that had excellent jobs, but we all know what has happened. And I think it has reached the point of where we all have to think a little bit more about those people out there homeless and not look down on them and say, oh, they're a bum, because they definitely are not bums. They're human beings like you are and I am, and I just hope that we can all think about them and consider them in our prayers and hope that things do get better for them.
Thank you, Agnes. We're going to go on to our next pilgrim here from Germany, see what he has to say.
Excuse me. I would appreciate if, you know, they can speak slowly, because some of us English is our fourth language.
Sorry.
Try to speak slowly but loudly and...
I have that bad habit of talking.
I know that.
I'll try to speak slow. Until 3 years ago, I lived in East Germany, and since then, I have been traveling and visiting about a dozen communities in England, Scotland, Ireland, and the States and Canada. Communities like Holden, where people, for whatever reasons, live together, I think, for an idea that unites them, that makes them stay together for some time, and that reaches out beyond these people that live there in the particular place. And I have spent different lengths of times in places like that, from just a few hours to more than a year. And moving between these places, from place to place, crossing paths with so many people, seeing so many faces, meeting so many stories, interacting with so many stories, becoming part of so many stories, and adding stories, faces, places, people to my story has become a way of peace making. I discovered that very recently. When I left Germany 3 years ago, I left out of curiosity to travel, to see the world, to explore what it's like to live in another language. And these are still reasons for me to move around, but there's something else that's bigger than that, that incorporates all of that, but it's like a sail, or maybe even like the wind itself, that makes me move. And I think it's touch. I think it's like touching somebody's face. It's like hugging a tree. It's like smiling in the sun. What makes me move? And exploring places like Holden, where people deliberately choose to live together with other people who deliberately choose to live with people. Visiting these places, for me, has become like a metaphor of something that's growing in many places, that's spreading out, and that is touching in many places all over the world. And I think it's going to grow more.
Thank you. We'll go to Mike and let him share his experience.
Thanks. Like Agnes, I too, as I introduced myself, was in the Lutheran Volunteer Corps. I was in this year, I'm not sure, were you in?
I was in 3 years ago.
3 years ago. And I had a lot of similar experiences to her, but many different experiences, because unlike Agnes, I didn't work directly with the thousands, the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in our country and elsewhere who are in need and who are hungry or homeless. I worked at the Federal Public Policy Office of the Lutheran Church in Washington, D.C., and worked there specifically on environmental issues, which many people, I mean, recently those have become very popular issues tied in with justice and peace, peace for all of God's creation. And justice for all of God's creation is something that many people have come to realize is very important in recent years, as have I. And in my work, I got to make new connections for myself and for others, and what that means. In a specific area that is called environmental justice or environmental racism, which I learned a lot about this year. I didn't know anything when I went to Washington, D.C. about this issue, and probably most of you may not either. It's a new kind of term, but it is the fact that is being shown more and more often around the United States and elsewhere in other countries as well, that both poor people and people of color are disproportionately impacted by the waste, by toxic waste, by deteriorating lead paint in their homes or their workplaces, by all these different environmental factors that make people ill and sick, that may give them cancer, may give them reproductive problems, may affect their learning or their nervous system. And this is something that's become very tangible for me this year, in a sense of tying together peace and justice for people and all of God's creation, in that all too often when I think about the environment, I think about places like where we are here at Holden and the gorgeous beauty and grandeur of the mountains and the forests, the trees and the water. And all too often I had separated people out of the environment and not seen them as important or connected to the environment in this issue of how people are being impacted by environmental issues as well as the environment has given me a whole new understanding of what justice and peace is, because it combines all these different elements and is far broader and far more reaching than I had seen in my life before. And so as I got to work on public policy, and then in the future now, as I go out and do new things, this new issue is going to really affect what I think about people and how we treat each other in all kinds of different ways, both in our placement of our wastes and the peacemaking and the war making that happens, and ways of overcoming that it's far more complex and more difficult than I ever imagined until this last year. And that's one of the big things I learned in LBC, because I lived in a city with 40, 50, 60,000 homeless people in the District of Columbia. And these people are some of the people in our country that are facing this disproportionate impact of pollutants, of lead paint and waterways that they can't fish in or swim in because they're polluted. And so I'm seeing a far bigger and more complex puzzle than ever before, and realizing that it will take many hands and a long time for us to put the pieces together in a way that would make God's creation the way that God would like it.
Thanks. Mike? Turn to Jim.
Before I came here, I was for 14 years in it, serving a parish in the center of Phoenix, which was mostly a typical Lutheran church. It was mostly people that were descendants, German or Norwegian descendants. But by the time I arrived as pastor, the church had become very small, and most of the neighborhood was Hispanic. And so when I first came, I remember one day a man came into the church, and I speak Spanish, and he was asking me, he said he needed a place to stay, he needed food and clothing, and I asked him, what part of Mexico are you from? And he said, I'm not from Mexico, I'm from El Salvador. And I said, well, what town are you from in El Salvador? And he said, well, I'm from Santa Ana. And Santa Ana was a town that I had ridden my bicycle through. Way back when I was in seminary, I went with three friends, and we rode our bicycles from Detroit, Michigan to La Paz, Bolivia. So I'm kind of a pilgrim too. but he was just the first of many people for me to meet. I probably met over the 14 years, I probably estimated one time I probably met about 5,000 Central American people that came through Phoenix. Because our church was right in the center of the Latino community, and people in the beginning, I came in 79, and the wars in Central America really increased just beginning in 79 and 1980. So I was right there near the border in a church, a struggling church. I learned a lot. One of the things that I learned about myself, and I think it's true of all of you, is that it's easier to care about what you know. And so that when that man came and he said, I'm from Santa Ana, and I could see Santa Ana in my mind, then I could relate better to him. As some of the rest of us, other pastors, other people in Phoenix started to talk, I found out that other people were having the same experience as I was having with Central American refugees. I also started to talk to people who had been struggling to try to protect Central Americans. And at that time, there was a lot of the news media. Ronald Reagan had just been elected president. And he really, his platform was that he would stop communism. And so he really closed his eyes and pointed on the map, and his hand fell on El Salvador, and he said, "This is where I'm going to stop communism." It could have stopped in, he could have been anywhere. But that's, and so the Salvadoran people were the ones that were murdered and killed by the death squads that Ronald Reagan paid. And so all these people were coming across the border. They went through Mexico to the United States, and they were coming to Arizona, to California, to Texas, and there were people all across the border having the same experience I was having. And then some of us tried to bring people to the immigration court. And I remember one of the men I went to immigration court with lifted up his shirt, and he showed the bullet wounds. And the judge said to him, "How do I know you didn't get those wounds in a fight in a bar?" And he was deported to Central America. We have files and affidavits, for example, Santa Ana Chirino Amaya, who was a young man who ran because he didn't want to be in the military, and he was deported back to El Salvador, and the day after he got off the airplane, his body was found in a shallow grave outside the airport. He'd been murdered by the death squads. We knew stories about this. I knew people in El Salvador. I had friends in El Salvador. And so some of us started thinking, what can we do? Some of us talked about the idea of a sanctuary cities. And then some people in Tucson came up with church as sanctuary. And the key idea behind this, however, was not to hide the people, but to put the people in front of the news media and let the people speak and let people tell their story why they were leaving Central America so that everyone could hear. And then we organized committees and groups to bring people across the border. And then we had in our church, our very church, we had the sanctuary counselor who fanned the people out and communicated with Chicago, the Chicago Religious Task Force, and then people were placed around the country. The key element in public sanctuary was that the power really resided in the voice of the people that were being persecuted. And if those people could speak, then things would change. It was not to hide people, it was to give people the power to speak. And people who are powerless in that situation became powerful. Became so much a threat that the United States government then hired spies to come into our churches. And we had started a Bible study group because one of the forms of powerlessness that existed among refugees was that they were afraid to speak to each other. So we started a Bible study group where we could study something safe, like we studied the book of Exodus, which of course is safe because it's in the Bible, but it's dangerous because of its message. Well, finally, a number of people were brought to trial because of the spies that came into our churches. And we were able to talk about, and one of the spies said that in our Bible study, we sang revolutionary songs. We sang one song from Nicaragua, which is Vosos el Dios de los Pobres. And that's one of the songs we sang every night. And that became part of the transcript in the trial. You are the God of the poor. Oh. And so I remembered it was something that Saul Alinsky, a great organizer, had said. As he said, just keep doing what is right, and pretty soon the government will do something stupid. And that's what happened. And it was such a wonderful thing that we studied the book of Exodus, because at the same time that we were learning and working, we were learning that what the people of Israel did, they didn't always know where they were going. But they always knew that they had to take the next step. And that's key to any organizing effort for justice, is that when you take one step, it's going to create a whole new situation. And the two choices are step forward or go back. And those are really, as in your, when you're in the process of justice making and the process of creating new reality, the only two choices are forward or back. Well, they're sideways, but that's a step too, and that's a tactical step that sometimes you have to make. And so we learned some things about tactics, about organizing, about analysis. But one of the core things that I learned, I think my time's probably up, huh, is that one of the major apparatus in this country that prevents justice is propaganda. And so one of the things that I learned is if all of us here, for all of our justice efforts, if we don't start to come to grips with and deal with and analyze and talk about and come and really confront the propaganda machine that exists in our country and in the world, we won't be successful in justice. Propaganda is really like, it reinforces, in the old biblical terms, the old person. It reinforces the old ideas. It reinforces everything that keeps the bad situation in place. I'll give you one example of propaganda. Right before I left, the Phoenix basketball team, the Suns, mm-hmm. were in competition with the Chicago Bulls for the championship, the world championship, they call it, of basketball. And I know it's a world championship, it's only people in the United States. But that's some propaganda too. But anyway, they were in competition, and it came down to the end, and every day in the newspaper, the headline was, in bold letters, what the Phoenix Suns had done. One day I remember a woman from Guatemala had crossed the border, and she died in the desert because of the desert heat. And it was the same day that the Suns were competing with the Bulls that day. Now, which event do you think was most important? The woman that died in the desert. Which one do you think got the headline? That's what I call propaganda. We think when we read the newspaper, we get the news. But we get the news from the point of view of the rich and the powerful and the people that want things to stay the same. Sports are a distraction, and as long as the media hype sports and hype all these other things that will distract us from the real issues of life, who lives, who dies, who gets poisoned, who doesn't get poisoned, if we don't, as Christians, deal with that. Now, and then we learned one last thing, I think, and I've learned, and I'm still struggling with, is that you don't understand reality unless you're in touch with the poor. That's right. You don't even know about the world unless you're in touch with the poor. And Jesus said it this way. Jesus said, Blessed are you poor, for yours is the reign of God. And then when Jesus had the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus looked at the people, and Jesus didn't look at Herod, he didn't look at the palaces, he didn't look in the White House. He looked at the poor that were sitting on the hill, and he said, "You are the light of the world." And so unless we're in touch with the poor, we don't know what the world is. We're in a delusional state. And so those are just some of my things I learned and some of the things I went through.
Thanks, Jim. Yes, you did go just a slight bit. Guess which one of the people? By the way, propaganda. Today, the headline in the paper is about the defense budget. Colin Powell, who's our chief military officer in this country, said it's true that we no longer have the communists to worry about, but now we have Korea, Iraq, and other demons arising. That was the word, demons. Propaganda demonizes the enemy. We're going to let the panelists, if they would like, respond to one another briefly. Then I'm going to ask if the our NADA guests, there's something you wanted to address or respond to, and then others. Would you like to say anything to one another?
I would like to ask any of you that were involved in, well, that, what do you think is the relationship between the individual, our efforts, and our obligations to work with other people for justice? I guess my question is, when we start to form groups to work for justice, a lot of times we get mad at each other. And we don't agree or whatever. I mean, what are our obligations in that area?
Well, I think one thing we definitely have to do is try and get over this disagreement. I did see how well things worked at the place where I worked. As I said, they had a list of all the churches in Baltimore. They had a list of 3,000 volunteers that they could call to come in and work. And this was really a program that was set up as an example of what can be done if people will work together. And without working together, nothing can be accomplished. And it wasn't just, I was a Lutheran Volunteer Corps. I worked through Associated Catholic Charities and all the churches, Methodist, whatever, Presbyterian, Lutheran, Catholic, they all worked together to bring food for these people. So it was a joint effort that was really paying off. And that's what it takes, is a joint effort between people.
I think I just followed that, and I mean, I learned working in public policy that we do most of our work ecumenically with other faith groups and other denominations, and that the power of when we can speak together is far more happens when you can join others and speak and ask for things and demand change, than if you are an individual crying in the wilderness. Little happens. And it's a real struggle. I think LVC, the Lutheran Volunteer Corps, really shows that, because you're living in community with other people that are working in other placements. And it's a real struggle to live together, because you bring in so many differences, and you spend half your energy just trying to work on your differences and not necessarily moving and working on the broader agenda of bringing justice to the world. But that is, I think, a necessary precursor, a necessary first step that has to be taken.
There are things to be changed out there, and there are things to be changed in here too.
Any of the NARDA people like to speak?
I can't remember the names. The first and the paid. You know, we were talking about getting themselves involved in helping the homeless and the hungry people. And I was just wondering in my head that, you know, in as much as we appreciate, you know, organizations that are helping the homeless, the hungry people, have we sat down to discuss or to look the look into the root causes of, you know, people being homeless, or why people are hungry, why people are poor? Because in as much as we continue to provide for them, it will never end. It is going to be there forever. But have we sat down to discuss or to look into the root causes? Why are people poor? Why is it that people are hungry?
Right.
And have we come up with, you know, answers? And if we have come up with answers, what have we done to those, you know, answers?
I think that's a really important consideration to bring up, that it's not a matter of charity of always just giving your money or your time. It's a matter of, I think, community and working together and asking people and listening to people and what their needs are. Their needs might not be food or housing. Their needs might be something entirely different. And most people know for themselves what is best. I mean, in the issue of immigration, people might not necessarily want to be coming to this country. We in this country think everyone wants to emigrate to our country because it's the best country. But a lot of people around the world, most people around the world, think that they would like to stay in their own home.
Yes.
And maybe if we can solve problems in their own home country, then we wouldn't have people that want to emigrate to ours. And it's not a matter of closing our borders, it's a matter of opening our minds and listening to the questions and the concerns that they have and helping them get to the answers.
Just to continue with that, the reason why I'm saying so is that when I think of other African countries and also maybe in other parts of the world, is that people have become poor. Not that they have chosen to be poor, but, you know, their resources have been drained by the so-called superpowers. You know what I mean? And then at the end of the day, we are saying they are poor, and, you know, the stereotype of information you have received as if they have chosen to be poor, forgetting that, you know, it is their resources that we have gone and drained. And then at the same time also, the superpowers have, you know, come up with ideologies whereby they impose on those nations that are poor. They have like the IMF, the World Bank, that will always determine on what to buy or what to do with those poor countries. Just to give an example of my own country, whereby it's an agriculture country. We produce a lot of food and we export a lot of food. You will find that, you know, in the principles, the producer is supposed to be the beneficiary than the buyer. But in our situation, it's always the producer who is poor. Mm-hmm. And it is the buyer who becomes rich. You know what I mean? So those are some of the, you know, the unjust things that are happening. What have we done, you know, in such cases?
Good question.
I think that in regard to that, I always try to remember a liberation theologian, Segundo Galilea, who said, his phrase about that is, he says, the liberation of the poor and the salvation of sinners. And he says that in the structure of our world right now, the major sin of the world is the separation between rich and poor. And when the poor are liberated from their oppression and poverty, then those of us who are rich will be saved from our sin. Because the sin is oppressing the poor. That is the sin, the definable, greatest definable sin that exists in our world today. The vast majority of the world is poor, and there are a few who are rich. And the salvation of sinners and the liberation of the poor is one act that goes on at the same time. And so if we don't work on the economic equation in the world, we're just deluding ourselves. We're just thinking that we're being nice, but we're not doing anything. It's the equation. It's the people that I know that come from Central America come because they get paid $2 or $3 a day to harvest coffee to send up here. Well, we wouldn't permit anybody to work for $2 or $3 a day here. Yet the rich countries like the United States, in reality, treat the rest of the countries as slaves, because the rest of the countries have to do all that work for $1, $2 a day. And so countries like the United States, Japan, most of Europe benefit from the poor labor of the rest of the world, just exactly what she was saying. And if we don't work on that, we are not doing justice.
Very much moved by this sermon by the fireside, I'd like to say a word. Because I didn't have much time at the Nada session, I didn't mention about the justice in Japan. Many writers from abroad or inside Japan writing about Japanese politeness, very much about that. But nobody mentions Japanese justice. Just 2 weeks ago, newly elected Prime Minister Hosokawa, he mentioned the Pacific War, 15 years war, was the invasion war to the whole world and to Asian countries. He's the first person who said that. Japan was very slow to learn from Germany, since Weizsäcker, President Weizsäcker said we committed very big sin, crime to all the world through Nazis movement. But Japan was the league when they had a war, but they had a very relationship at that time. But after the Weizsäcker speech, the Japanese politicians, leaders, didn't learn from him and did not say some word about that. And now the issue is in the United Nations and in Japan and in Korea, in Taiwan, in Holland, because of the so-called sex slaves. Japanese armies just went around Asian countries and they captured women there, even small girls, and they carried Japanese women, Korean women, Taiwan women, and Dutch women, and they had, kept there, and they made them serve sexually. But the Japanese leader didn't say about that, and those who, through our global education, or those who are interested in the human right and human justice, they started to talk about that. So now, those issues are on the paper. But officially, Japanese leaders said that we didn't find any public official document of issued by government, so we didn't say that we did that. But those persons who gathered women from Korea, from Taiwan, from Indonesia, from Holland, some of them said that we really did, according to the order of the office, officers of the armies. So we are the witnesses. We Japanese armies just did gather those ladies to serve the Japanese men. So that if people, as you said, if people see the tragedy or poor or obscured or pressured, then through those phenomena, we can understand there's no justice at all. but there are still suffering people. So now who are from Korea, there are some, maybe about 10, 20 women came to Japan and they sued because we ourselves were captured by your men and we served for many years. So we could not lift our faces up until now, but now people start to raise their voices. That's why we came here, to raise our voices, so that there was their injustice in Japan. So we have to raise our voices to dig up those, you know, grave issues, facts.
I want to bring you back, Jim, to the question you asked earlier about doing it alone as individuals, or you have to combine efforts. I strongly believe that one person doing something about peace and justice, and even the integrity of the creation that we are all part of, is like dropping a little pebble in a big lake. If we can combine our efforts, the US with the Caribbean, with the African, with the Czech, and with the Greece, and with the Japan, if we come together, we will make a greater impact on the justice issues and on the environment, rather than doing it individually. Yes, we have differences, and thank God we have differences, because we need that. If you were like me, I wouldn't seem to, it wouldn't make sense, you know, but we need those differences. And if we can use those differences not as negatives, but as positive, then we would be able to go straight ahead and, you know, influence the powers that be, the government, whoever, to make an impact on this justice thing.
Who else would like to? There and then back there.
Paul, why are you worried about Korean military? Why are you worried about Korean military?
I did not talk about Korean military.
Oh, I have question to leader.
You were addressing that to me, were you?
Yeah.
Why I was worried about Korean
military?
Yeah.
Military service.
I quoted from Colin Powell, who is the head of the U.S. military. He made that statement today, and I suppose what he was saying was that, did I say Korea? I believe he said North Korea.
Oh yeah.
And their capability, perhaps, of nuclear weapons, and Iraq. But the important thing, my own view is that those are not really legitimate kind of fears, but it's an attempt to demonize somebody to justify our continued militarism in this country. That's my view. And if we happen to get rid of those, then we'd find somebody else to try to demonize, because we have to have some excuse.
That's right.
To keep this powerful military operation going. At least those who want that. That was my view.
That's true.
There was another hand back here. I didn't.
Small smile.
Yes.
I would like to put one question. What is the role of the churches in actual situation? And I think this is my question. Can nobody answer so long each particular church has not asked herself if she is here only for believers. It means for herself, or if she is in the hands of God as God's instrument addressed to everybody, if he is believer or not believer. When you tried to answer this my second question, I would then continue. Thank you.
Did we understand the question? I'm not sure that I really got it that well.
The question is, what is the role of the church in all of this?
Yes.
Is the church in the hand of God to be used by God? Is it just for believers or for the entire creation?
Okay, that's the question that's been addressed to the forum. And then you will have something further to say. Would you like to speak to that?
Go ahead.
The church is going to say nothing.
You're going to put tape over my mouth by saying.
I would simply say, after working for a national church organization, that it is up to individuals and individual churches like Jim's to make differences, that the national church bodies, for example, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, we are not, as the broad big church, in the position of saying things for individual churches or individual members of that church. It is up to the individuals in that church, in their local congregations, to start doing things and start being involved in the work of justice and peace in the world. And that only then will the bigger church, both national denominations and the church at large, the church of all believers, be about the work of justice and peace.
Albert.
Anybody else want to add to that?
And I will after she does.
Well, I just wanted to say, though, that certainly the church, the Lutheran church, I mean, we still need a spokesman, a leader. Chilstrom does make some policy. He did come out about the Gulf War, you know. And sometimes I think we need to, from the top, make policy statements that the churches can then, you know, grab on.
But I take that now, and you've heard an answer at least.
I have not heard if the church is here only for believers, if it means for herself, or if it is instrument in the hands of God, addressed to all people, if they are believers or not believers. So long I cannot receive the answer to this question, I cannot continue.
I think that the church should be an instrument of God.
Yes.
For the world. And Martin Luther even said that a Christian is a little Christ. If all of us are little Christ, then that means that in some way we as a church should do what Jesus did, which is give up our lives for the world. In other words, our agenda should not be to save the church. I've gone to lots of conventions and people in the United States, and people talk about evangelism. And the way they talk about it is that we're going to get people for the church. And a lot of times that's very transparent because it's said by people who are worried that there's not enough members in the church. And so their agenda is something other than what God wants. Their agenda is a self-serving agenda. It's for the service of the organization, church. One of the realities in the United States is that the church is a strong part of the culture. All the major denominations and now upcoming fundamentalist denominations as well, and we Lutherans are very strong in this point, is that we reinforce culture and power through the symbols, the way we act, the way we do things. So very few pastors, very few pastors on the day when the basketball team played and the woman died, almost none of the pastors, I think, in the city I lived, used the analogy of the woman dying in the desert in their sermons. They almost all used some story about the Phoenix Suns. And I bet you that was the same in every city. If you would have had a championship basketball team, you wouldn't have had pastors preaching as much about as their examples, much about some homeless person. You would have had them preaching about the championship basketball team as some kind of disconnected analogy about the world. I believe is that the church needs to be evangelized. The church needs to hear the news from the poor. The church needs to hear the news that we can give up our life and God will still be with us. We can give up our riches. We can give up that. I mean, I'm still working on that myself. You and I all are. But so I think the church should be for the world, but it is not doing that very much in the United States. And I somewhat disagree with you. I think the ELCA should be about that. But you and I all need to be organizers, just like we're organizers in society. We have to be organizers in the church. Right. We need to see corruption in the church. We need to see mediocrity, and we have to name it. And say that the church is an evil institution sometimes, too.
Jared? Yeah, listening to a representative from United Nations and World Council of Churches, they were saying that it's more of a hands-on, hands-off kind of work with trying to gain more or less a peace between countries. And they only work together in conjunction when there's humanitarian need with different countries and when there's natural disasters within countries. Does the World Council of Churches and different countries, along with the United Nations, work in conjunction with each other?
I think you've had an answer that says the church is ready to give itself up. It doesn't exist for itself, but for the life of the world to proclaim God's good news.
You didn't say it's ready
to do
that.
That's what we'd like it to be, but I don't know that anybody's ready to do that. But now, would you give us the rest of your second part?
My question was answered from Jim. Yeah. He said that the church is not here only for ourselves. It is enough, it is helpful for me that I have the freedom to continue. Do you think that the given situation of the world of today is made from individual persons? It is only President of the United States responsible for the situation of the world for today? It means no individual person. Although by changing on the position of president, still we have the same structures.
That's right.
And when these structures are okay, I can sit back and not to continue. But when the structures are a reason for three biggest obstacles for the surviving of the humankind, and we can mention these three obstacles, when it is no peace, then it will be war. In some decades before, it was possible to say that the war is ultima ratio, it means the last instrument for the politics. But it is not possible to repeat it. Because when you start the war, in the time of existence of nuclear weapons, the old theories of different Christian churches can no more function, because in the situation before, it was possible to win the war or to lose the war. Just now, everybody would be victim of the war. Because the consequence of the war with the new weapons would not like to respect the frontiers between different countries or different blocs. So that war is no more the last instrument for something which can help. And the same with justice. So long. Each people shall not have the minimum for surviving. It has no thing to discuss. It is very nice when we are giving witness how we are working to help the people who is homeless and so on. I shall not speak too long. And with the nature, there are three obstacles. Do you see any future for the humankind?
Yes.
It would be enough when we shall discuss and ask us who is responsible for the situation in which we are living. But when the church is here not only for the believers, not for herself, then it is really, it is another question if it should be or if it is or not. It is a question how it is based on the gospel or the witness of gospel. And it is instrument in the hand of God. So that I think that my question was not question if the church institution is here instrument in the hand of God, because I know that it could be not other than to be that each institution is instrument for person, not only church institutions, all existing institutions. It means that the given situation is not acceptable when everybody of us would like to survive. So it is necessary, when we are speaking, to make any kind of conception what is to do to change the structures which are reason for the danger that the humankind cannot survive. Thank you for my long speech.
Thank you.
Just a moment. Therefore, the title, Justice, Peace, and Integrity of Creation. therefore this World Conference to this topic. Therefore, three obstacles for survival.
I'm not sure. Do we just go on, or do we? Or I think we're supposed to cut these at about the hour. So I, unless somebody's just itching to talk, we're going to bring this forum to a close. Thank you, panelists. I'm not sure, but I heard at least some instances of people working in specific situations towards peace, justice, and the integrity of creation. And there's a lot more to do. Let's all do it.